This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart. Coming up, Vanuatu not giving up on its battle to secure independence for West Papua. The University Vice Chancellor, driven out of PNG by threats of arrest, tells his story. And teaching rugby players in the Pacific from the top down about the dangers of concussion.
In the amateur and community game, all you can do is educate people on the symptoms. And that's particularly relevant in Samoa and Tonga and these places where it's just physical game and so much emphasis placed on the hit and the tackle.
Find out more about a new documentary on concussion in rugby called Knocked later in the programme. But first, the government of Nauru hasn't given up its fight against the group of anti-government activists known as the Nauru 19, despite the newly convened Supreme Court ordering a permanent stay of prosecution. The long-running legal battle stretches back to June 2015, when the 19 were first charged with offences linked to a demonstration outside Parliament. But in his more than 100-page judgment, Justice Geoffrey Mukie is scathing about the government's involvement in the case since then, labelling it as executive interference and persecutory conduct, particularly after they failed to comply with an order to provide funds for the defence. The government has responded, calling the judgment wrong in law, and they say they will appeal. But one of the 19, former Foreign Minister Matthew Batsua, is urging them to respect their court's decision and resist the temptation to simply toss the judgment to one side.
If they decide just to throw everything at the window, then they've got a lot to answer for, including the fact that they'll be flying in the face of systems that they've set up. They also have to remember that they appointed this judge to come in and hear this case, respecting the fact that it is a highly political case and it needs to be handled by an independent judge. That's their decision, so they have to respect all that.
Justice Mukie's judgment stretches to more than 100 pages and it does not reflect well on the Nauru government's conduct. I consider that this is a very rare case, the judge says, where executive interference has been such that the continuation of the prosecution will continue an abuse of the process of the court. He highlights the denial of the defendant's legal representation, resistance to their obtaining legal assistance, and the public denouncing and vilifying of the defendants and those seeking to assist them, who include Solicitor Christian Hearn. He says the judge's suggestion that the Nauru 19 have been persecuted would be hard to refute.
I mean, that's certainly something that you could conclude from the very strong words Justice Mukie has used in his judgment. Yes, it's a complex ruling. It's taken into account a long history. The delay in particular was a very significant factor in all of this, and the conduct of the executive in contributing to that delay, as was the failure of the Republic to commit funds to resource the defence.
Another former Nauru Member of Parliament, Roland Kuhn, was locked in his own legal battle with the government and separated from his wife and children until he fled the country in 2016. A former colleague of the ex-opposition MPs among the Nauru 19, he says the government's tactic is one of trying to bleed their opponents dry.
I do expect that the government is not going to react well. I do expect that they're going to continue to try and fight. They know that they're fighting with national resources against people who are strapped for resources, and that's their style. That's how they've been fighting their battle, just out-resourcing whoever is fighting against them.
Should the Supreme Court ruling stand, then that will be that for 16 of the Nauru 19. But Solicitor Christian Hearn says the situation is a little more complicated for the other three, who actually pleaded guilty to minor charges at a very early stage.
We have filed on their behalf appeals which are still pending in the newly established Court of Appeal in Nauru. So while this is a great outcome for the 16, we still have to deal with the three that have pleaded guilty. At this stage for the 16, the practical effect of the decision is the same as if they had been acquitted. And from here, we just have to see if and when the Republic of Nauru is going to file an appeal.
Roland Kuhn has kept in regular touch with the Nauru 19 from overseas and kept faith that justice would win in the end. But he says he has no faith in the government.
We have been quietly confident that it was going to be positive. And yes, I think we've been justified in that confidence. But we still have a government that has absolutely no respect for rule of law and will continue to frustrate and contradict the courts.
They should read this judgment. They should accept the fact that the successful appealing of this decision is very remote. I mean, it does not serve any constructive purpose for Nauru. The defendants have not been able to travel. They haven't been able to get jobs. They've been blacklisted from opportunities. Some may argue that's been punishment enough. So I think they're trying to appeal this very comprehensive judgment. It will be a very hard task for any prosecutor.
While Matthew Batsour and his fellow defendants celebrated their legal victory, one of their number, Sprint Dabado, was absent. He's in Thailand undergoing urgent medical treatment after the government finally allowed him to leave the island just a week before the Pacific Island Forum leaders' meeting put Nauru under an international spotlight. Now, Mr. Batsour is hoping the news from the court will help speed former President Dabado's recovery.
He's, like us, overjoyed about the outcome, so he's in really good spirits, which is really good to hear, considering that he's undergoing some very serious medical treatment at the moment.
Former Foreign Minister Matthew Batsour, one of the Nauru 19, after winning a significant legal victory over their government this week, but the battle to clear their names is not over yet. Now, while other Melanesian countries have been stepping back from the cause, Vanuatu have been ramping up their support for West Papuan self-determination, and they plan to continue lobbying other nations in the region and around the world. They tried hard to build their case during the Pacific Island Forum leaders' gathering on Nauru recently, seeking backing in particular for a push to win a seat on the UN's Decolonization Committee. But Australia and Fiji have long-standing reservations on the issue, and Papua New Guinea are not prepared to buy in, a decision which, as Catherine Grauer reports, has irked one of the country's more outspoken politicians ahead of the 43rd anniversary of PNG's independence.
I'd like to see PNG, you know, join the rest of the Pacific and stand up for our people. These are our people. They're Pacific Island.
Gary Jufu is a politician not afraid of causing a stir. The governor of Oro regularly uses his Facebook page to voice his opinion on various contentious issues. He's also fond of Twitter, and it's on that social media platform where he recently wrote this.
If your government cannot vote for West Papua to be free, your country is not independent. It is controlled by another nation. That means you are not independent. That means the 16th September means nothing. Let that sink in as you wave your flag this Independence Day.
He elaborated when speaking with Pacific Beach.
For so long, Papua New Guinea has remained silent about this. And here's the Minister for Foreign Affairs constantly coming out and saying that we recognize Indonesian sovereignty. That's fine. But what we could do is voice concern about the brutality, about the arrest, and about the fact that here are people who want to be independent. You know, if we're going to remain silent on that, then it implies that we are some way or another controlled.
But why do you interpret that it is control?
You choose a side. You're either against what's happening there, or you ignore that.
Attempts have been made to get comment from the Indonesian Embassy in Canberra and also the Indonesian Foreign Affairs Ministry. Pacific Beats also tried to speak with PNG's Foreign Minister, Rimbik Pato, who's recently publicly reaffirmed PNG's support for Indonesian control of the West Papua region. The woman behind Vanuatu's push, Laura Linney, was also reserved when asked about Gary Jufu's specific comments.
Vanuatu has no problem with Papua New Guinea. It understands clearly the issues raised and concerns regarding the reality that they have with being a border to West Papua. That's understandable.
Laura Linney was recently appointed as Vanuatu's special envoy to West Papua. She joined her Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister as they held discussions last week in Nauru on the sidelines of the Pacific Islands Forum leaders' meeting. They want West Papua relisted on a key UN decolonisation list. But given the differences that exist between the different member countries, the matter didn't make it onto the official leaders' agenda. What it got was one mention in the final leaders' communique.
Leaders recognise the constructive engagement by forum countries with Indonesia with respect to elections and human rights in West Papua, and to continue dialogue in an open and constructive manner.
Laura Linney maintains the differing opinions won't cause problems for Vanuatu's cause.
All I can probably say right now is that Vanuatu is happy with the current momentum in rallying support for the UN draft resolution that is taking to the UN next year.
But we have seen quite clearly some countries speaking out against that sort of move. Papua New Guinea specifically, the foreign minister has made it pretty clear that their support is with Indonesia. Do you acknowledge that it's very unlikely that you're going to get support for for some of those key partners?
It's clear, and it's not anything that, we're not aware of. Of course, Australia, Papua New Guinea and Fiji have expressed their reservations, and they've made their stand clear because of their issues that they have regarding this agenda that Vanuatu is taking to the UN. But Vanuatu is not too concerned, and the Pacific is not the only country that we need to rally support. We will be going to Africa, we'll be going to Europe, Latin America, and the Caribbean. So the reservation that we've got from Australia and Papua New Guinea and Fiji is not going to stop what Vanuatu intends to take to the United Nations in 2019.
That's Laura Linney, Vanuatu's special envoy for West Papua, ending that report from Catherine Grau. And you're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. The former head of Papua New Guinea's University of Natural Resources and the Environment has hit back at the suggestion that he fabricated claims about threats to have him arrested. The then Vice-Chancellor John Warren alleges the threats were made when the Chancellor Kenneth Sumbuk confronted him in his office in Rabaul. That conversation was openly recorded by Professor Warren, and he has handed extracts to the ABC. The atmosphere was very different 2 years ago when Professor John Warren received a ceremonial welcome to Rabaul and set out to restore confidence in PNG's leading agricultural university.
Your Prime Minister was very welcoming, but he didn't give me a pot of gold.
Wind the clock forward 2 years and the relationship between Professor Warren and Kenneth Sumbuk apparently began to sour after the Chancellor appointed a female friend as registrar over his Vice-Chancellor's head. Professor Warren challenged the Chancellor about what he called his unwarranted interference in the running of the university. Shortly after that, Professor Sumbuk flew to Rabaul to confront Professor Warren, accusing him of spreading rumours that he, the Chancellor, wanted the Vice-Chancellorship and control of UNRE. During the recorded conversation that followed, Professor Warren says he was threatened several times despite persistently denying that the rumours had come from him.
The only thing that I have said about that is that I actually would be very happy if you were to be the next Vice-Chancellor.
The
place could do a lot worse, and that's the only comment I've made about
it. Look at me, John.
But it appears Professor Sumbuk was not about to change his mind and was ready to take matters further, a lot further.
Let me tell you, there are staff members who have actually heard it a number of times, and I will be testified. And I was actually going to get a police warning for defamation.
Professor Warren says he was shocked.
I knew that he was figuratively holding a gun to my head. The message that I got was not necessarily I'm going to take you to the police over this particular case, but I can take you to the police over any trivial matter.
The PNG government's higher education secretary, Father Jan Schuber, hasn't heard the taped conversation, but he puts a different interpretation on remarks attributed to Professor Sumbuk.
Yeah, I don't know if you can call this threat, maybe warning. We have to define what you understand by threat or warning.
First thing I did was get on the phone to the lawyers and to the British High Commission and speak to friends about the situation. And the advice that everybody gave me, you don't take any risk.
And for Professor Warren, that meant leaving the country fast. As far as any formal investigation is concerned, Pacific Beat has been told two different stories. In the most recent version, Father Schuber says such an investigation would not be conducted by him.
I send an independent person. I have a report here.
So you've not been there yourself since this matter blew up?
No, I was in Rabaul, but I am not going to investigate the issues. I just went to Rabaul to make sure that students in the classroom and everything is at peace.
But in an earlier interview with Pacific Beat 2 weeks ago, Father Schuber said that he had carried out his own inquiries and found no substance to Professor Warren's claims.
I didn't expect a man of such a caliber to invent such a story, because I personally make inquiry to this accusation. The council was very cooperative, the chancellor was very cooperative.
But John Warren's argument is that if his claims don't hold water, why did the chancellor travel to Rabaul in the first place?
It does seem a little bizarre why you would fly into East New Britain solely to tell me that he's not going to take me to court over this issue, but he clearly could do. So what was the purpose of that meeting if it wasn't to threaten me? I kept repeating, I'm scared, and Jan kept saying, relax, it'll be fine. I'll get rid of this man, I'll move him into a different position so you don't have to worry about it. I said, well, fair enough, I'll try, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt, but I repeat, I am scared. And for a fortnight, I didn't sleep, and I was physically ill with stress.
Father Schuber insists he was unaware the encounter between Professor Warren and the Chancellor had been recorded until now, but he says he's not about to go looking for it, even though a copy has been passed to a member of the University Council.
If John wants to resolve anything, he has to read the letter, sign it, and send the evidence. Then I can act. Right now I have nothing. I learned just from you about the tape. Can you imagine why he didn't send me if he wanted to resolve it?
So the ball is back in John Warren's court, but in the meantime, he says the new regime at UNRE is unpicking the systems he put in place, while staff who supported him are being demoted, a claim Father Schuber says is untrue. True or not, and despite the stress and fear he says he endured during his last few weeks in PNG, Professor Warren is not bitter about the experience.
I don't regret going and working at UNRE. I've made some wonderful friends there, and I will remain in contact with them and help them and support them at a distance for the rest of my career, I would say.
And in the meantime, UNRE is on the lookout for its next Vice-Chancellor. We stay in Papua New Guinea, where the response to the polio outbreak has been scaled up again, with the national vaccination campaign now targeting all children under the age of 15, so some 2 million more than previously planned. Children under 5 are the most vulnerable to polio, but anyone who isn't vaccinated can contract and spread the virus, and often without exhibiting symptoms. Two more cases have been confirmed in Enga province this week, bringing the total to 12. But while that number may be small, as Lauren Beldy reports, specialists in the field say that figure indicates that hundreds or even thousands of people could be carrying the disease.
Following the confirmation of another two cases comes the announcement. The number of children to be vaccinated under the nationwide campaign has now tripled.
About 25% of our confirmed cases are children over 5 years old.
Keith Felden is the Emergency Polio Outbreak Response Coordinator from the Global Polio Eradication Initiative. He says the age range is being extended from all children under 5 to everyone under 15, because many older children have also missed out on routine vaccinations.
As much as, 40% or so of the children over these years do not have full immunity.
With the scaling up of the campaign comes new commitments from Papua New Guinea's neighbours. Australia has announced $10 million in support to combat infectious diseases like polio. That's nearly half of the estimated cost of the current outbreak response plan. PNG has also been in discussions with Indonesia about precautions they're taking to prevent the spread in neighbouring Papua province.
This month they're going to open up border vaccination points on their side, and agreeing to vaccinate children who come over to their side from Papua New Guinea, and then vice versa, that Papua New Guinea will vaccinate children who come over from their side.
The campaign in the capital, where one case was confirmed last Friday, will start on the 24th of September before going to all provinces early next month. The 12 children who have been confirmed to have polio all showed signs of paralysis, a typical symptom. But only one in about 200 people infected with this type of polio will develop paralysis. And Mr. Felden says the small number of confirmed cases likely indicates a much larger number of people who are carrying the virus.
With 12 cases, that is like tip of the iceberg, that we know there is as much as 1,000 or more infections.
For those who do develop paralysis, it can often be chronic. And Mr. Felden says it's also time to think longer term about how to support the children who have been affected.
They need to have some rehabilitation services and also support for their educational opportunities. And that's something we're now looking at and trying to get resources for.
Disability advocate Ipul Poaseo knows all too well the lifelong effect that polio can have. She contracted the virus as a baby in the 1960s and still uses a walking stick.
When I had polio, it actually affected both my legs, and I was crawling. I can remember I actually was crawling. I couldn't walk.
Ms. Poaseo is encouraging parents, especially those in rural areas, to take their children to be vaccinated.
I was walking in a shopping area one time, and there was this little boy staring at me because I was using a walking stick. And the parents pulled him away, and I said, no, tell him to come so I can talk to him. And so he came, and I said, listen, the reason that I am actually limping and using a walking stick was because my mom did not take me for immunization. And so when your parents tell you to go for immunization, you should go. And he smiled, and the parents were happy.
The confirmation of the case in Port Moresby comes just 2 months before the APEC summit. Just one more reason for authorities to try to quickly get this outbreak under control.
Lauren Beldy with the latest on the escalating concerns over the polio outbreak in PNG, a country that had been officially polio-free for almost two decades. And finally, on this edition of Pacific Review, rub some dirt on it and get on with the match. That's one past player's reflection on the way the game of rugby union used to treat concussion injuries. And even though times are changing and much work is going into concussion awareness, training and treatment, players often still feel under pressure to skirt around the system and stay on the field. These are the issues explored in a new documentary movie called Knocked, and it will strike a particular chord in the Pacific, where fans expect their players to be hard at it from first minute to last.
If you didn't get up and play on, it was sort of seen as you being soft, particularly, you know, back at home where it's all about that collision and trying to be dominant in the contact area. If you got smashed and it was around the head and you got knocked out, you didn't want to show that because it was a sign of weakness.
The founder of Pacific Rugby Players Welfare, Dan Leo, admitting to the makers of Knocked that in his playing days, his own welfare wasn't always a priority. And it's stories like that from the former Manu Samoa international and tragedies like that involving advocate Peter Robinson, who lost his rugby-playing son as a result of concussion injuries, that inspired co-producer Tom Fox to make the film.
It just felt like this is something that needed to be not only broadcast to the rugby public, but the public in general.
Concussion is the most common type of rugby match injury at a rate of 1 in 5, and those figures have been rising. But as the Rugby Football Union's Dr. Simon Kemp explains in the documentary, the symptoms are still far from being well understood.
So this is the real challenge with concussion recognition. Sometimes it's obvious, loss of consciousness, unsteadiness or a convulsion. Sometimes what you see happens within the first few seconds and then goes. Sometimes what you see develops over 12 to 24 hours and may be as subtle as a player not sleeping well or feeling a little bit more emotional than normal.
I think Sam Peters, a journalist, noted that he was talking to Lewis Moody, a former England international, and he said it used to be actually funny if someone was sick on the side of the pitch, used to laugh at them if they couldn't remember where they were. And I think from that point to where we're at now, there has been a big shift. And I think players are more willing to talk about it now.
And on the back of that wind of change, Tom Fox says education is essential, and doubly so in a region like the Pacific, and particularly at the lower levels of the game.
In the amateur and community game, all you can do is educate people on the symptoms. And that's particularly relevant in Samoa and Tonga and these places where it's such a physical game and so much emphasis placed on the hit and the tackle.
As regional training manager for Oceania Rugby, Talima Wonga is tasked with getting the message across about concussion and how to deal with it.
We are also moving into making welfare part of everybody's challenge, right from the administrators, the parents, the teachers, the coaches. They have to understand this. So it's the intention of Oceania Rugby always to make sure we look after our players.
But as another Irish international, Lynn Cantwell, confesses in Knocked, the temptation to play on regardless can be overwhelming.
I'm a physio, I should know better. I got concussed in the first game of the World Cup and I was aware that if I had spoken about it, I would have been ruled out for the rest of the campaign.
Talima Wonga says a player's desire to stay out there at all costs is perfectly understandable, but it's an attitude that has to change for the sake of their own welfare.
Some of them will try to go around the system, and this is where we are training the union and advising them. And every AGM and every training week, we run a session on player welfare and concussion and understanding, recognize and remove. Not only face-to-face, but we also have materials online.
And as Tom Fox points out, there is more than one way to get a concussion.
It doesn't necessarily have to be a bang to the head. It's the rapid acceleration or deceleration of the head. So it could be an impact on somewhere else in the body, but that force is applied to the brain. So I think it's massively relevant in Pacific Island countries and me in the amateur level that there's an awareness around the symptoms.
As a former Manu Samoa international, Dan Leo says the debate about concussion has made him think about would he want his child playing rugby. But Talima Wonga says serious as concussion is, it's important to put matters in a broader context because the risk factors, even in rugby, are still small.
The most dangerous part about a rugby game is not the rugby game itself, but the travel to and from. It's been found that they are prone to be in an accident when they are travelling to and from the game rather than the game itself.
Nevertheless, Oceania Rugby will continue to spread the message about concussion as widely as possible in the Pacific and the education to go with it. And to watch the documentary Knocked in its entirety for free, you can go to rugbypass.com. And it's a documentary that makes for a sobering watch, but it's so important to get the message out at every level of the game. So rugbypass.com is the place to go if you'd like to see Knocked in full. And that's it from Pacific Review for another week. If you'd like to catch up with Pacific Stories on demand, then do subscribe to our podcast. I'm Richard Hewitt. Thank you for listening, and do join me next time if you can.